Welcome to session 214, Structural Holes and the Routinization of Charisma, a Social Network Analysis of the Mormon Succession Crisis of 1844. If I could remind you all to, this is the first session of the day, your cell phones are probably all on, so take them out and turn them to silent or vibrate, and then you can just leave them that way the rest of the day. At the end, we'll have time for question and answers. There's a microphone on this black box on the front table up here, and if you just speak loudly, it should pick you up. There's not a mic to speak into, but if you speak loudly, the mic should be sensitive enough. And so I'll ask you just to speak up when you ask your questions. Our main speaker today is Joseph West, a graduate student in the Department of Sociology at the University of Arizona, where he studies culture, social movements, and social network analysis. Now, Joseph is young, but he's presented at Sunstone before, and oftentimes, one of the great secrets in scholarship is people do their best work when they're young. And then they make a name for themselves and they coast on that for their careers. And so Joseph is young, and maybe this is his best work, so you're in for a treat. The respondent will be Michael Quinn, who it is not true that he did his best work as a graduate student. and probably needs no further introduction, but Michael Quinn has blazed the path for all Mormon studies scholars, and it's a real treat to have him here. We look forward to him responding to Joseph's presentation, and we'll proceed. Thank you.
Okay. Is this the recording?
Yes.
So can everybody hear me? Can you hear me? Chris? Okay. Because I'm going to be kind of getting up and going to the screen when I'm getting to the visual stuff, but so I'm just going to sit here for now. And to change my slides too. I'm Joseph West. This is co-authored work with Eric Schoen, who's another graduate student at the University of Arizona. We both work together. Our main work is on both of our work is on insurgency, violence, and terrorism. And this work got started in conversations of mobilization and charismatic leadership, and questions about what happens when leaders of fundamentalist groups die, what happens to the group after that, and had the connection of knowing that there was data available on this particular case, and so that's how we started into this. So this is kind of a side project for me. And the other thing I want to say in introduction is that I'm a sociologist, not a historian, and this work could not be done without the work of many people working in history. Of course, Michael Quinn, who's here responding, but also many others whose work I rely on in my narratives, in the paper. The paper is actually written geared towards a sociological audience, so I've adjusted this presentation for this audience, but in the paper it relies heavily on narratives from historical work, augmented by these structural quantitative analysis that I'm going to present here. So I thought I would start with a brief introduction to what social network analysis is. And to do that, I'm going to show a little clip and then explain why this clip is relevant. But I'm sure most people here have seen The Matrix. Let's see.
Command F, it will go full screen.
Oh, thanks, man. Okay. Oh, I also wanted to apologize in advance to Carl Youngblood because my presentation is so hokey compared to his awesome presentation yesterday. I was like putting it together last night, and I was like, man, this is so 1999 PowerPoint, but it's what I got. But okay, so. About 30 seconds of this. Here we go. Make sure.
I know why you're here, Neil. I know what you've been doing. I know why you hardly sleep, why you live alone, and why night after night you sit at your computer. You're looking for him. I know, because I was once looking for the same thing. And when he found me, he told me I wasn't really looking for him. I was looking for an answer. It's the question that drives us here. It's the question that brought you here. You know the question, just as I did.
What is the Matrix?
The answer is up there, Neo. It's looking for you. And it will find you if you want it to.
Okay. So basically, that's the introduction. That's the at the beginning of the movie where Neo's expressing his desire to find out what the Matrix is, and what the Matrix is in analog to what I'm to what social network analysis is the hidden structures and that are kind of controlling us and keeping us determining our behavior. Okay, that's kind of the negative side of it is what social network analysis is trying to uncover. On the more positive side, social network analysis is about uncovering the relationships that make our action possible in the first place. So it's not always the dark side of these relationships that are controlling us. But just an example is, even in this room right now, there is a set of relationships that's basically determining everybody's behavior, okay? It's a formal setting here, so it actually has to do with a role that everybody's taking. I can speak because I'm in the role of the presenter, but if someone were just to get up and randomly start talking, or, you know, most of us would think that would be incredibly rude, because we understand the relationship that exists right now, and it's the relationships that are kind of structuring behavior at all the time. And I'm in a formal setting like this, or in a family setting, or an informal setting, and that's kind of, I'm going to have examples of both of those kinds of structures that existed in the early, during the succession crisis. And again, and this is kind of just thinking relationally, let me make sure there's nothing else I want to say about that before. Yeah, okay, so I do want to say that, another thing about social network analysis, it started more heavily being researched in the 60s and 70s, and in the most extreme radical structuralist perspective, persons are kind of defined as a intersection of relationships, okay? So all agency disappears from the individual, and the person just becomes defined as how every single relationship in which they participate intersects in a human body, and in that from that perspective, all culture, including religion, arises from this structure of relationships. Okay, and this is kind of like the old Marxist perspective in sociology that all culture and law, everything like that, the world of ideas is determined by the material sort of set of relations that exist because of the capitalist modes of production. And then of course, Weber's response to that was showing that religion and culture was actually a prerequisite for the rise of capitalism that Marx is claiming determines determines culture. And so this is an important question that I'm dealing with here, is this relationship between structure and culture, between the beliefs, the institutions that Joseph Smith put forth, the theology, and then the structure of relations that came out of that. And so this is an important question, not just for Mormons. It's, of course, an incredibly relevant question for Mormons who want to understand their origins and how the institution began and what set it on the process of institutional evolution that it was set upon. But these are important questions that sociologists have been dealing with since the beginning of the discipline. Okay, so I think that's... yes, one other thing, actually. This is crucially important. There's an important homology, a similar logic between social network analysis and kind of like Mormon thinking, as I interpret Joseph Smith, and that is that social network analysis rejects the liberal perspective. I mean that in the classically liberal sense of like autonomous individuals that kind of act freely. Fundamental to the perspective of social network analysis is that that's not what a human is. A human is actually duality in the softer sense. I was saying that in the radical sense, there is no agency left in the individual. But even in the softer sense of social network analysis, there is a duality or co-constitution always taking place between the relationships that a person is embedded in and the persons themselves, their choices of how to act. And in Mormon thinking, I think there's a similar contrast with Protestant theology, where in Protestant theology it's about the individual and the individual's relationship with the divine, whereas in Mormonism it's very explicit that without our communities we can't even reach our greatest potential. We're not fully human without taking us out of the context of our relationships. And so, again, it's like a perfect fit to use this method of analysis to study what happened because of the homology between the assumptions of the method and what Joseph Smith was actually trying to do, which was create these relationships that would last. I want to be quick and go through this as quick as possible. And if I get to some of the details of what happened in the succession crisis, that will be a bonus. Those have been described beautifully in Michael's book and other sources. So I'm going to try to get through what is kind of like my original contribution, which is this formal analysis. But also, I would also like to, if I have time, discuss more of the story, the drama, and the qualitative information and that is also a part of my analysis. But first, this idea of structural holds. This is just a theory within network analysis of what how do actors derive power within a set of relationships. And this is a theory put forth by Ronald Burt, who's a business. He's a sociologist, but he works in a business school, so most of his work is on management settings. And so I'm going to present a couple of things here. I mean, this is just how this is an. These are called ego networks. So an ego network is things that are connected to you, and this is right out of his book, his 1992 book of how an ego network might expand. Okay, but then here this person has 8 relationships. But there's kind of 4 different couples. Maybe this is 4 families, and then over time this expands to 16 relationships to 4 communities. Okay, and that's kind of just an example of network expansion. But then the structural holes idea is that you're actually more advantaged if you can minimize the number of ties that you have, but without minimizing the number of ties that you kind of have by implication. Okay, so if in the first one, you have to put in the energy into maintaining 16 relationships here for 16 contacts. Here, you only have to maintain 4 relationships, and you still have access to these 4 networks because these people are connected. Okay, and this gap is the structural hole. And there's measures that go in. The measures that I'm going to present, I'm just going to try to briefly give you the conceptual idea behind the measures for time's sake and because it's pretty technical. This is just another example of how someone might advantageously transform their network. Here you can see they have some total amount of contacts, and here's their number of personal contacts giving them access to this network. But then by restructuring their network and adding this relationship here, they vastly improve the number of contacts that they have access to. And this is most relevant in information. Like people who are in this position of in the structural hole have access to information is the most important thing. That's the most empirical finding. But it's also things like support, gaining support, getting power in political back and forths within an organization. So I think that's what I want to say about that. I'm doing well on time. This is the kind of theoretical framework, is Max Weber's ideas about forms of authority. And this is also another just crucially important idea for Mormons, I think, because I think one of the reasons that Mormon authority is so successful institutionally is a kind of like the difference between rational legal authority and charismatic authority is blurred in Mormonism. Okay, and let me just explain briefly what these things are. Charismatic authority is what we're talking about with Joseph Smith. Okay, he's a bearer of charisma. I mean, when people say that, kind of challenge the notion that Joseph Smith was or was not a prophet, I think that from a sociological perspective, it's pretty naive to make the claim that he was not a prophet. He clearly was. When being a prophet or a bearer of charismatic authority is a function of relationships. If you're thinking about it relationally, the number of people that followed him, he was a clear exception. Weber even mentions him. Weber's writing in the early 1900s. That's just 78 is the publishing date of this particular translation, but he's writing in the early 1900s, and he is talking explicitly about Joseph Smith. I mean, if you're reading his work on organizational on the routinization of charisma from charismatic to rational legal authority, you're reading the transformation of the LDS Church. He's describing it as an ideal type, but it's right there. I mean, if you understand anything about how Mormonism evolved. It's like it seemed like he was right there describing exactly what happened. He even talks about Joseph Smith, although he was kind of prejudiced. He made a comment that Joseph Smith was an ideal, a perfect example of charisma, although he may have been a very sophisticated swindler, was his thoughts. But he's writing from Germany, so we'll forgive his prejudice there. But the third kind of authority, which I'm not going to talk about, is traditional authority. That's just like the authority that a father carries in a home, or just something that's just based on, you know, it's just the way that it's always been, so people give deference to that person based on that. Okay. So in Weber's work on how charisma gets routinized into organizations, he identifies six potential means, and actually five of those were explicitly identified in by Quinn and other historians of what took place in the Mormon succession crisis. That there were several persons, there were eight or nine persons identified as potential successors, but they fit five of these six categories that Weber identified in his work. So again, it's just a highly relevant case to trying to test Weber, to dialogue with Weber's theory, and let me just make sure that I'm not missing anything. Oh, yeah. Okay, one example. Okay, one reason why I think, another reason I think that can, the success of the LDS Church can be attributed to is Joseph Smith's early, he was routinizing his charismatic authority from the very beginning. Okay, and one example from that is actually canonized in Scripture, and that's when Hiram Page and the seer stone, Hiram Page was a person who came forth with his own seer stone and was kind of his own, bearing charismatic authority on his own, and people were believing in the revelations that he was bringing forth. But then Joseph Smith realizes the problem of this, that charismatic authority alone, just pure prophecy, is not enough to sustain an evolving institution. So even in as early as 1830, he starts institutionalizing the role, and his role is starting to blur the line between his own authority, between rational legal authority and an organization. He gets his authority from his place in an organization, or charismatic authority. He gets his authority from, you know, revelations from God. And so he's routinizing very early on, and that's, I think, the complexity of the institution that emerged is part of that, is that he started so early, and I think that's part of what explains, and this will be evident in the social network analysis, that's part of what explains why it was successful, why it continued. I mean, a sociologist named Rodney Stark has said that Mormonism is such an important case to understand, because so many people study new religions, but Mormonism is one of the few new religions that we have data on that actually succeeded, and so it becomes this incredibly important case for understanding how that process works and why was it successful. Okay. So this is kind of my research question. In cases where multiple culturally viable possibilities for succession are present, how does one take place over the other? I'm going to kind of skip this. We can talk about this more if there's time for details. But basically, I think hopefully most people have a basic sense that June 27th, 1844, Joseph Smith is assassinated, and he had established several different options for succession. Hiram Smith, his brother, was maybe the most obvious, but he also obviously died. And so there was this, in terms of the authority structure, there was different possibilities. In terms of people that Joseph Smith had designated, there were different possibilities. So there was this crisis that went on for, several weeks. And the other thing I want to say on this last bullet point is that I don't think that my analysis necessarily contradicts anything that's like official, or doesn't necessarily have to be challenging to someone who wants to just go with the official story of what happened. And obviously what did happen, I mean, the story, the narrative in the discourse of the church is that Brigham Young was presented in front of this crowd of a couple thousand people, and the countenance of Joseph Smith kind of came upon him, and that's how people knew that he was supposed to be the prophet. And again, I'm not necessarily challenging that happened or didn't happen. I'm just talking about the structure of relations that existed in the events that led up to that point. Okay, so here's just an example, or here's a table that shows all the different people that could have been examples, or that could have been successors, and how they fulfill the Weberian ideal typical solution for succession. A lot of them you'll see twice. I mean, ritual and designation by the charismatic leader, there was those are basically the same thing, because Joseph Smith was giving blessings and stuff that, you know, making pronouncements of some of these people that they would eventually lead the church. So all of these people kind of had a claim, and I'm going to talk about... yeah, that's what I want to say there. I'll talk more about it. Okay. Got to get to it. We compiled data from... It started actually in a term paper that just used the data in Appendix 6 from Origins of Power by Michael Quinn. I just mapped all those relations that he had put there. But then I wanted to do... We got the different quorums, Council of 50, the Anointed Quorum, the Presiding High Council, the Quorum of the 12, and the Council of 70, and the First Presidency. And that equaled 76 people. And then we collected ego networks on each one of those people. So we looked up in the personal ancestry file all their relationships, and then all their close ties, and then we cross-referenced those with each other. And so then we created a person-to-person network of the 76 persons that's close tie relationships, okay? So we're not really looking beyond, like, first cousin or closer. Okay, I think I kind of talked about this. Okay, so this is the first network. I apologize that you can't see it. I mean, this is the best I can do. I can point out a couple people. I mean, the blues are the groups, and then the red is the persons connected to those groups. And so you can see, like, here's William Marks, who's one of the major contenders. Brigham Young is right here because he's connected to the Anointed Quorum, the Council of 50, and the Quorum of 12. And one thing to understand about this structure is that the First Council of 70, the Quorum of 12, the First Presidency, and the Presiding High Council, those are mutually exclusive groups, so basically you can only be in one of those. So what that means is that the maximum number of groups that you could belong to is three, okay? You could belong to any of the more ecclesiastical councils or quorums, and you could belong to the Anointed Quorum and the Council of 50. And so the most degree, what we call degree, which is the number of connections, is three within this particular thing. So that's really important in understanding the structure here, because you can kind of see, like, this is where a lot of overlap was. And if you look at these names, this is really actually kind of like the area of contention. So, I mean, the Andrew Ehat thesis is basically that it was all about what was going on in the Anointed Quorum, these ordinances that were taking place. And that really is represented well visually here, because this is kind of like the contested space of the network when you're just talking about the Quorum Affiliation Network. Now, this network implies this is what's called a two-mode network, because you have persons and groups, okay? But this implies a one-mode network. Stay with me. This is the kind of... this is where... It's a persons have a tie in this network if they share an affiliation, okay? That's it. And so you can see this is really dense. Some of these people shared multiple affiliations. And so this is just what that looks like, the person-to-person ties based on that other one that we just saw, okay? And then the measures, this is kind of some measures of structural holes. This is their number of ties. So Brigham Young had 60 ties within that. William Marks and Alpheus Cutler both had 71, because they were both in the Presiding High Council and the Anointed Quorum and the Council of 50. And then this is the effective size. So this, conceptually, what the effective size is I talked about what a structural hole is. It's like you're trying to reduce the redundancy of your ties. And so this is... It subtracts out the redundancy. It just has this formula for subtracting out the redundancy of these relationships. So this is the effective size. And you can see that according to the affiliation network, it was actually William Marks and Alpheus Cutler who were the most advantaged in that. And, I mean, Quinn makes the argument that if William Marks had pushed his claim more, he really was in an advantageous position. This just supports that he really was. But he actually didn't want it as bad. He kind of supported Sidney Rigdon, So same with Alpheus Cutler. Alpheus Cutler actually supported the Quorum of 12 at first. He eventually broke off and made his own claims. But again, he was in this pretty advantaged position. Again, this is just according to this one measure of structural holes. Constraint, none of these actors were really constrained here. But constraint plays a huge role in the next network. And what constraint is basically if you're tied to someone, if you're relying on one particular person for your effective size, that you will. That's what constraint is measuring. It's just a formula that measures that. I mean, that's all I want to say about that. I could talk more about how these are calculated. Efficiency is just this divided by that. So how efficient your network is. Okay, here's the structure of relations. This is the family structure of relations before Joseph Smith died. So you can see Joseph Smith puts himself at the center, and he's tied to all these people, most of them through marriage, but like here's this little star is all the Smiths, Hiram, William, Erastus, or that's it's Ephraim Smith, George Albert, and who's the S?
Samuel.
Okay, so that's what the structure looks like. Here, look at the structural Holes measures for Joseph Smith before. This is within the close family tied network before, and this is like exactly what Burt's theory would predict, that entrepreneurs are going to structure the networks around them in ways that gives them lots of structural Holes, and that's exactly what happens. It's highly efficient. He has 25 effective ties, meaning non-redundant, for an efficiency of 92%. And he's very non-constrained. And you can see that by the fact that there's lots of ties that don't go to other places. His only constraint is probably coming from the redundancy right here. So then Joseph Smith dies, and the structure turns into this. Okay, so let's just contrast that one more. So this is what it looks like. These are people that were in the hierarchy, but they're called isolates, but that just means they weren't part of the strong family tie network. Okay, not that they weren't important, it just means they don't have any relationships that are first cousin or closer. And now here's what it looks like afterwards. And here's Brigham Young, here's William Smith, and Marx and Cutler are both isolates. But the structure is just significantly, so you can kind of see this is like a visual example of the power vacuum that happened. It kind of just, all the structure that was there disappeared as soon as Hiram and Joseph were gone. And so then running the same structural Holes calculations on these, I mean, again, I have the measures for everyone in the network, but I'm just presenting some of the interesting ones. No one that was a contender really had measures, had a, anything after the death of Joseph Smith and Hiram, except for these two, and William Smith is not even in Nauvoo at the time, he maybe didn't recognize his position. His brother had just died, if he would have pushed it, if he would have been there, he could have been more of a player than he was. But he's not really part of the story because he's absent. But again, Brigham Young's degree, which is just his number of ties and his effective ties, are pretty efficient. And then the constraint is because there is redundancy in their networks. You can see that. But Brigham Young, they're pretty closely constrained. But the comparison, I want to just show that right here, let's see. Okay, yeah. See, I want to show that this is before Joseph Smith dies. Brigham Young constraint. William Smith's constraint goes from 0.43 to 0.53. Okay, so the fact that whatever it was about the structure of relations that existed when Joseph Smith died, William Smith became much more constrained. His main ties were to this. All the other Smiths, so there's a lot of redundancy there. So that's kind of taking away from his ability to use his effective network well. Okay, so I want to get back to the to this. So that's kind of like here's what I want to say. Here's like the punchline to this structural analysis. Like, who cares? Who cares about this? I think there is some really important reasons to think about this, and that is that, the prominent theses that are out there, including Ronald Esplin and Andrew Ehat, there's some important contrast between them. I don't want to put them in the same category, but both of them, I think, basically argue that the reason why Brigham Young was able to rise is because of what was going on with these ordinances, okay, with... the Esplin thesis is that he calls it a succession of continuity. It's what Joseph would have wanted, and Ehat is slightly problematizes that idea of a succession of continuity, but still kind of makes the claim that it was about these institutions that Joseph Smith was, these practices that Joseph Smith was setting into place. And as a sociologist, I think the first reaction to that is to think like, well, let's think more about the material relationships that existed and not so much about these beliefs. And, you know, these, they can be important, but again, this kind of like instinct to go to the material relationships. And I think that what this analysis shows, what the formal analysis shows that's an important contribution, is that it required what Joseph Smith was doing, the culture that he was creating, and then the culture that he was creating laid the foundations for a material structure of close tie relationships, and that was really the mechanism. Okay, that's kind of my main argument, is that the mechanism for succession that Joseph, or that Brigham Young used to his advantage, was this structure of close tie relationships. And I think that that's an important addition to what's already been written about this, the succession crisis, and I'm interested to hear the response to that, if that's even a contribution or not. But so I think that I'm going to end there. I think that there's so much cool, interesting stuff that happened that I could talk about. In the paper, I go through a bunch of historical, detailed historical examples that further augment the claim that family relationships were the mechanism, more than relationships over the ordinances and the religious practices and the ideas. It was the family relationships that were driving people's action, that were orienting people's action to what they did. I'm not going to go into those specifically because I want to leave plenty of time, but yeah, that's what I got. So.
As a note of introduction, you've had a kind of a two-pronged presentation today. One is the visual PowerPoint charts, which I also had access to in the paper, but also Joseph's presentation was primarily from a combination of outline form and extemporaneous comments, whereas I'm responding to a specific text. So my remarks are linked to that text, not to the to the PowerPoint and outline presentation that you have just heard. So there'll be some things, maybe many things, that I'll be saying that that don't relate exactly to the presentation you've received today. As a social historian reading through this paper, I was reminded why history as a discipline is more often listed with the humanities than with the social sciences. Its authors reformulate and expand some of my decades ago writings in ways that are both deja vu and through a glass darkly. This analysis by Eric Schoen and A. Joseph West combines historical sociology with mathematical sociology. While I have sometimes consulted and quoted practitioners of the former, the latter quite honestly leaves me in the dust. Thus, while my comments as an old-school social historian trained in the 1970s might be a bit dusty, I offer these remarks in appreciation of what I regard as an important contribution that Schoen and West have made today. Skipping back and forth through their paper, there are some quotable quotes that I particularly like. One is their academic quote, "Aim to elaborate how structure, agency, and culture intersect in the mechanisms of routinization of charisma." A zinger that I envy is their comment that the LDS Church, quote, "is currently recognized as a bureaucratic giant," unquote. The best, in my view, is their phrase, quote, "the transition from prophecy to practice," unquote. I would suggest that they consider the last phrase for a title or a subtitle of the articles that they will certainly publish from this analysis. In that regard, I suggest that in addition to their primary emphasis for a sociological periodical or Festschrift, they submit this to one of the humanities-oriented outlets for Mormon studies, In doing so, they should unpack most of their sociological jargon for a general audience. For example, they do this for the phrase, quote, single dyadic tie, unquote, which they immediately define as, quote, only connected to one other person, unquote. However, that same sentence's previous words, non-isolate nodes, also need explanation for common readers and listeners. As a related matter, some of this paper's narrative seems to get tangled in syntax, or perhaps it was I who got lost in translation. An example, quote, another actor who is connected to six others because they married into six different families, then they have a much broader potential base of support to draw on from within their family, unquote. Even though they and their grammatically refer somewhat ambiguously to others or to families, I thought that at the least one of those pronouns referred to the actor, and therefore should be he, she. In that regard, as for this paper's roads not traveled, I accept one of its stated limits, quote, because women are excluded from all other LDS institutional bodies aside from Joseph Smith's Quorum of the Anointed, and were given no formal authority within the church, they are excluded from the social network analysis of this paper. That's a practical limit. On the other hand, I hope that Scone and West will apply their statistical sociological skills to what they describe as a desirable future study, quote, a more detailed examination of the role played by women in the institutional development of the early LDS church, unquote. In the copy of this paper that I received, there seemed to be some glitches and some lapses in bibliography. For example, of a glitch in demonstrating, quote, structural features of the network, unquote, one sentence of the narrative begins, first, second, unquote, and seems to omit one of the two. One of this paper's very positive features is its diagrams. While I have usually preferred Venn diagrams to illustrate overlapping relationships or associations, the circle, pie chart type, where you show the intersections and what the where people or institutions overlap. While I prefer to use Venn diagrams to illustrate overlapping relationships or associations, the matrix charts shown here that you've seen are far more useful here as visual aids. Moreover, in their analysis of the 1844 succession crisis, what strikes me as the most surprising finding in their statistical analysis of structural hulls and person-to-person networks is how closely paired William Smith was with Brigham Young as the potential successor of Joseph Smith. And as Joseph pointed out, things could have been very different if William Smith had been in Nauvoo at the same time Brigham Young arrived in Nauvoo just prior to this meeting where the congregation or the assembled thousands of Nauvoo's Mormon population voted. Aside from their quantitative analyses, I am especially impressed by their qualitative analysis of how certain actors in the crisis acted against their own interests, such as William Marx and Alpheus Cutler, as he has pointed out in your presentation today. Likewise, I really like their corollary, which he didn't present here because of time constraints, their corollary that William Clayton began by acting against his own interests as a tactical effort on behalf of the immediate financial needs of the church, until Newell K. Whitney persuaded Clayton that such tactical support of William Marx as successor would strategically defeat the secret establishment of plural marriage, to say nothing of the political kingdom of God as manifested in Joseph Smith's Council of 50. All in all, Scone and West's combination of historical sociology with mathematical sociology has provided some very important insights into the 1844 succession crisis. Thank you.
So we now have opportunity and time for a few questions. Thank you. And if you don't mind, I'll take the initiative and ask the first one. Joseph, in your presentation, you talked about the maximum advantage is to minimize the first order contacts that a person has, but maximize the total number of contacts. Mm-hmm. But then in your data, I noticed that Joseph Smith seemed to have a very large effective size, a lot of personal first generation contacts. So how do you square that for charismatic leaders?
Well, this kind of looks like a wheel structure almost. And so basically, his thing is efficient because even though this and this are not connected to many others, it's still considered an efficient tie because there is still a structural hole between those, so they're not connected to each other. So in terms of the way that it's measured, these are efficient ties also, even if there's only one person. Okay, it would increase if there were more people connected to that, and it would decrease his constraint if that were the case. But it wouldn't. Does that answer your question?
Okay. So is that common with charismatic leaders that they'll have a lot of first generation contacts, or first order contacts?
Well, I would say that there's not that much data on that. That's what's unique and important about this particular case. Another thing to remember about this is a marriage structure, so he probably had important relationships to many of these other people. So, like, if we were to take something like the work that's being done and has been done by Devery Anderson on the LDS temple worship, documenting all these like things that happen in the Nauvoo temple, there's so many structures of relationships that's happening there. There's people being tied together through ordinance. There's people that are performing ordinances on others. That's a tie. So there's multiple ties that you could think about. So, I mean, I'm hesitant to come down strongly in answering your question because this is only one set of relationships. But I would say, yes, okay, there is, I can think of a few examples in the literature of when people are trying to place themselves in a place of power, and what Bert calls entrepreneurs, they're the structure that they're creating around themselves will often look like this, with many structural holes between the different places that they're tied to.
And the second question for you is, Brigham Young and Willard Richards were cousins.
Oh, yeah.
But Brigham Young was probably closer to Heber C. Kimball, arguably.
I know, right. That's
and so have you considered tying in very close friendships like that?
I know. That's an excellent question. I was going to actually say something about that because, Heber C. Kimball is disconnected. The other important thing here is that if you look at this one, Brigham Young has a degree of seven in this one. He has seven people tied to him. But by 1847, so in 1844, Brigham Young just claims leadership for the Quorum of 12 as a whole. But then, because if he's to make the argument that it's about the First Presidency, then Rigdon has an advantage. So he can't argue that it should be the First Presidency that succeeds. It's the Quorum of the 12 as a whole. But then his tune changes in 1847 when he's basically restructured everything to his advantage. And by that time in 1847, he's actually doubled his degree centrality within these 76 actors, and also added several others that were also tied to him. So if you were to do the same thing, which we didn't do, we didn't do it because by that time the Council of 50 was sort of obsolete, the Presiding High Council was sort of obsolete, so we didn't do this. But if you were to take the structure 3 years later when Brigham Young actually became the president, it would look much more like that Joseph Smith one. He tied himself through marriage to Heber C. Kimball and several others that had prominent spots. And so that kind of gets to your question that, you know, the network looked like this when Joseph Smith died, but it evolved to look more and more like the original one that Joseph Smith had.
I'd like to make a couple of additions, and that is that there's an advantage that Joseph Smith had over any other, most other charismatic leaders through polygamy. And polygamy allowed him to unite himself through marriage to many, many different people that would not be available to a charismatic leader who is monogamous. The other thing about friendships is that those polygamous marriages and kinship relationships can be quantified without any ambiguities. but friendship is full of ambiguities because it's such a personal decision. Did Joseph Smith have a closer relationship to Brigham Young than Brigham Young had to Heber C. Kimball? How do you quantify that? How do you even qualify it? And so, even though it's important, I don't know how that could be quantified, because to say that the relationship between Brigham Young and William Marx was closer than Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball, you have to put all these measures in that can't be number crunched. So I'm not, as important as it is, I don't know that it would ever be subject to the kind of analysis that they're doing.
So is it an inherent limitation on the analysis?
Well, I think it's the inherent limitation is that you're putting a quantitative number on this. In this case, it's just one and zero, but you can't quantify the friendship as much. So, but you know, you can still map the structures, and that's why we chose close family ties too, because it's measurable and it still provides a structure. So yeah, I mean, that's always going to be a disadvantage to any quantitative analysis, whether it's researching survey data or whatever. It's like putting interpretation on what these numbers mean. Yeah, there's always an inherent limit. That's why I tried in the paper to really refer heavily to the historical data to kind of give substance to the formal analysis.
Yeah, my question sort of goes to Michael's point, and that is about the polygamy, but more broadly, did you look at ceilings? So that, you know, including man-to-man ceilings that would be more than a friendship, though maybe less than a kinship. But nevertheless, it could be a one or a zero. Did you look at that? And secondly, did you look at the polygamous marriages?
Yes, so these include the polygamous marriages. So in this, his family ties is obviously his brother Joseph Young and then his cousins Willard Richards and the other Richards, Levi, I can't remember, but the rest of them are through marriages. Maybe not polygamous marriages, but the other thing is this is 1844, so the ties to other men, that's a great suggestion, and I think that it would be interesting to map the network as it evolved, because and to map those kinds of ties to other men and any kind of ordinance ritual tie that was intended to create a strong family tie. I mean, that's what I'm interested in, because it's the culture that created the possibility for those ties to exist, and then the idea is that then those ties become action orienting. But those things didn't start until Brigham Young wasn't tied to anyone else in this affiliation network until after this the 1844 crisis. I mean, pretty sure about that. But
yeah,
is that okay?
I'm interested to see how you answer this question. In the unlikely event that a true believer actually reads your analysis, I'm wondering how your analysis sort of fits into the notion of divine orchestration, because it seems to me that in addition to all the complexities of the universe, to suggest that a omnipotent God or an omniscient God actually orchestrated this and made it happen to give us today's present church, it seems to me to be a very complicated process.
I mean, I guess that's like what I would respond is that it was a very complicated process. I mean, I don't think, well, first of all, I don't know what the phrase true believer means, really. So my first response would be to problematize what that means. Also, just to reiterate what I said before, I don't think that nothing about the idea of an omniscient God is exclusive of what happened here, just like, that's all I want to say about that. I don't think. Okay.
Sorry, I'm just thinking about what Mike said about friends, and, you know, say, was Joseph Smith closer to Heber C. Kimball than he was somebody else? How do you quantify the friendship? How does that work in families? I mean, for example, I'm certain this is not true in my family, of course, but other families I've heard where sometimes there's contention and people might like a friend down the street better than their own brother.
Well, Joseph and Samuel brawled, right? I mean, physically.
William.
Is it William?
Yeah.
Joseph and William. I mean, they physically brawled as adults.
Yeah. And, and that's just a comment. But now my question is, was William Smith in the Quorum of the Twelve at the time?
Yes.
So he wasn't there.
He was one of the original members of the Twelve.
Now, just another, kind of a not related question maybe, but Orson Hyde wasn't there either, was he? He wasn't in town, was he?
No, almost all of the Twelve, aside from, actually the only member of the Twelve who was still in Nauvoo at the martyrdom was Willard Richards. All the rest were out as missionaries, but they were political missionaries. They were out for campaigning for the presidency of Joseph Smith.
Well, John Taylor.
Oh, and John Taylor, excuse me. So he was wounded, severely wounded, and because of his wounds, he wasn't involved in some of these early meetings that were talking about what should we do now.
Was Wilford Woodruff there?
No. No.
So then how could Wilford Woodruff and Orson Hyde later in conferences in Salt Lake talk about the mantle of Joseph?
Oh, well, we're talking about two different times. Yeah. End of July, June, all of July, they weren't there. But then at the 1st of August, they were in, Orson Hyde, Wilford Woodruff had returned to Nauvoo, and so they were there to witness the...
So Orson Hyde actually was there.
Yeah, to witness the transformation or the transfiguration.
It seems like the results that you get from the network analysis really has a lot to do with how you select what kinds of network relationships you're looking at. So in this case, you've distinguished sort of the quorum relationship network versus the family relationship network. It doesn't seem like you've made a distinction in the family relationship network between sort of birth family type families and the more ritualized family that you were talking about. And do you think that making that distinction would have any significant effect on this, or looking at the more ritualized family relationships?
I actually think that kind of goes along with your question that I didn't quite answer completely, and that is that it is important to note that the people who are connected to Brigham Young that were acting so much in his favor, Willard Richards essentially prevented the appointment of William Marks in an early meeting. He kind of like grandstanded a couple of different meetings to make sure that, to kind of lay the foundations for Brigham Young to at least come back. But see, that's not a tie through the rituals. And that's kind of one of the parts of our argument is that these. So I guess what I'm this is a really fragmented network because when when Joseph Smith died, the structure just kind of collapsed. But there was fragments left, and a lot of what's left is close family ties, not ritual relations. Willard Richards and Brigham Young are first cousins. But that's not completely true. There's still some of the structure is because of the family ties. Through ordinance and ritual. And so I think that it is an important distinction to make. I'm not quite sure how we would deal with that quantitatively. I mean, again, like a lot of these questions bring up just the inherent drawbacks, or not drawbacks, but limitations of doing quantitative analysis, that you always have to fill that with substance and understand substantively what is going on beyond just this structure of, clicking a button on your computer that spits out some measures. And so, yeah, I mean, great point. I think it's just important to take into account qualitatively as you interpret the formal results. So,
it seems to me from reading Mike's books and others for that matter that one of the biggest challenges that Brigham Young faced following Joseph Smith's death came from James Strang. Oh. Who, of course, was out of Nauvoo and didn't figure into these networks much, if at all. Yet he did present quite a challenge to the leadership of the Quorum of the Twelve and other contenders. I know this is kind of a qualitative question, but how would you characterize Strang's bid for leadership of the church as maybe a trumping somewhat of these family relationships that you've presented?
So what I would say about that, maybe there's other things to be said, but he is on this list, but I don't have anything to say beyond what the historians have already said about it, because he wasn't present, he wasn't part of the networks, and so he's not included in this analysis. I do discuss it somewhat in the paper, same with, there's a couple people, I mean, Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer also had succession claims. They weren't part of these networks because they were not present and were not part of the hierarchy. So I think there are plenty of other things. I mean, the other thing is that Hiram Smith, this is just part of answering your question. See, Hiram Smith here, he's right here. He's somewhat, he does have a prominent space in the network, but he probably had a really good claim and probably not any better spot in this network than Brigham Young or in the network that would have happened, that was there after Joseph Smith died, had Hiram Smith survived. And so that's another thing that sort of provides a challenge another possible contender that could have arisen that doesn't, you know, this analysis doesn't account for. So do you have anything to add about that? I mean, okay. So,
just
I mean, yeah.
One little peripheral statement. My understanding was that Orson Hyde was not yet back in Nauvoo for that gathering of the saints in early August.
His exact arrival and date in August, I'm not sure of. I remember vaguely now that there has been, I think it was Van Wagener,
yes.
Discussed how that his later testimony was an anachronism, that he was there when he didn't arrive in Nauvoo until after that conference and the Transfiguration. So, I'll have to stand corrected on that now that you remind me.
I think, doesn't Van Wagner talk about two meetings, too? Was there just one meeting, or was there a morning?
There was
an afternoon.
Morning and afternoon, right. Yeah.
So did you actually map those that were practicing polygamy versus those that weren't practicing polygamy? Do you have a chart for that?
I don't have a chart for it in this presentation. I kind of have a sense of who that is.
How do you think that might differ? Do you think that would add anything to...
Okay, I see what you're saying. I thought you meant the ties created through polygamy.
Well, the ties created through polygamy.
No, that's an important thing that I was... that I think is very... played a huge part in it, and one thing that Michael discussed in his comments that I also discuss in the paper is that William Clayton first supported appointing Marx, and then he was persuaded, he realized that William Clayton actually had a plural wife that had a child, and so we realized if William Marx is appointed and we do away with polygamy, there's this relationship that I have that will be, you know, cast to the wind, and so he realizes his own material interest in promoting Brigham Young instead of William Marx. And so I think that that did play an important role, but I think that's sort of accounted for in the idea that it was about these ordinances and it was about who was practicing within the anointed quorum. And again, I think that my analysis is perfectly conducive with that, saying that the culture that was being created laid the groundwork for ties, family ties, but it was actually the family ties that was orienting actors more than the ordinances were orienting.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It'd be interesting to see the map of that.
Yeah.
How that would map.
I mean, honestly, I don't...
relationships in there as well, not just the men.
I think that a lot of social scientists are like have this strong idea about what we need to determine causality one way or the other, but I'm perfectly comfortable kind of going against the grain on that and thinking that culture and structure, the causality is... what we say is endogenous, meaning that it's always rolling back on each other. There's not just one variable that's perfectly causing another, like structure is all the culture, all the beliefs is arriving just causally from the structure, but that it's culture is created, Joseph Smith puts forth ordinances and beliefs, and then that's then lays the groundwork for a structure of relationships, and then further culture is related. So there's this endogenous process between structure and culture that I think your question kind of gets at. But
well,
I'm
obviously not just looking for one or the other, a dichotomous view. I agree with that, the fact that it's more complicated, that it's more constructive to add more information. I'm just suggesting that it's one more piece of information that you could add to what you've already got.
You could basically add another blue dot for the club, polygamy club, as an organization like the Anointed Quorum or Council of 50, and that would be something that they share.
Because Yeah. Populating, for example, in the Community of Christ, if you ask them what this was about, they'll tell you that it was about the polygamists going west and the non-polygamists staying in Nauvoo.
Yeah.
Loosely, it correlates to something like that. We don't often think of it as like that. I'm just suggesting this one more piece of information.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's...
Well, our time is up. Thank you for the great questions and the great presentation and comments from Dr. Quinn. Thank you.